principal purpose of our voyage was not simply to gather the flora and fauna. That was my personal preoccupation. Rather, our mission was to explore and chart uncharted waters. To that end, the crew of the Beagle would drop a weighted line to the bottom and record the depth at regular intervals. The measurements were called soundings. They told us where we had been and would serve to guide those who followed.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, listen now to our program called Soundings. Thoughts and ideas about the present and the future with an appreciation for the past. Your host is Wayne Pond.
Dr. John Moline is the head of the Department of Philosophy at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Dr. Moline is a graduate of Austin College in Texas and holds a Ph.D. from Duke University. Professor Moline has published widely on philosophical issues, ranging from Aristotle, Euripides, Socrates, and Plato, to analyses of the nature of morality, philosophy and rhetoric, theories of understanding, ethics and environment, truth and science, the role of morality in teaching, sociobiology, and ethical relativism. Dr. Moline has held grants and awards from the Graduate School of the University of Wisconsin, the Institute for Research in the Humanities, the Spencer Foundation, and the Rockefeller Foundation. During the academic year 1979 and 80, Dr. Moline was a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center in North Carolina, where his research focused on the writing of a book on practical wisdom. Dr. Moline, welcome to the Center's radio program, Soundings. It's a pleasure to have you with us. Tell me about your work here at the National Humanities Center.
I'm working on a project in ethics entitled Practical Wisdom. That's perhaps a pretentious or ambitious sounding title, but what I'm trying to address is, I think, an important problem in ethics. It's the problem of a sense of priorities. We hear that phrase used a lot in criticism of people, and perhaps we use it in criticism of ourselves sometimes. We look back and we think that in ranking one kind of consideration over another, we make a mistake. We go for one value rather than another. It's easy to do this with other people, to think that somebody's acted very foolishly, that his sense of priorities is not straight, or perhaps even that this person has no sense of priorities. But it's, of course, harder to do that with oneself. What I'm trying to do is to clarify what a sense of priorities is and how it might operate, to develop a sort of model for the working of a sense of priorities. To examine this model and see if it will withstand criticism.
How old is that term? It sounds fairly modern, a sense of priorities.
I think it is. The term is modern, but the idea behind it is not. Mm-hmm. The idea is as old as the idea of wisdom itself. The idea that some things are much more important than others, that when we're thinking of what it would be right for us to do, we see reasons to do a lot of different things, and we have to make a hard decision sometimes as to which reasons are weightiest, which give us the best reason, which is the reason we ought to act on.
So you're talking not only about abstractions in the sense of love and death and justice and truth and beauty, you're talking about behavior.
I'm talking about concrete guidelines for behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And
for instance, what is a priority?
It may help to start with what I think these are priorities in. I think they're priorities in avoidance. One of the myths of our time, I think, is that there's something nasty and repulsive about the idea of the negative, of no-nos, when in fact I think that a list of things to avoid in fact, frees us. Because if the list is finite, closed, it's got an end to it, that leaves everything else open to our better judgment. If someone gives me a list of 10 commandments or a list of 20 things to do in writing an essay, or 20 things to avoid in writing an essay, that leaves me an awful lot of room. I simply avoid the things on the list, and everything else is open for me to decide on other grounds.
So the 10 commandments are a good thing?
I think so. It's possible to be oppressive about anything, of course. It's possible to be oppressive about quite positive instructions. Go out and be happy, for example. I defy anybody to do that head on. It seems a very short way to oppress oneself and become miserable.
Professor Moline, let's talk about, for instance, the self-help movement, the human potential movement. Is there value there?
Like any popular movement, there are a lot of strands to the one you're describing. There are, in my judgment, some very good things in this and some very, very bad ones. What they prove to be for a given individual depends on how the individual uses them. It's possible to sit down with a very superficial piece of pop psychology and read it and come out of that with something perhaps valuable that one may have overlooked. But if one takes that piece of pop psychology as a tract full of instructions by which to guide one's life, it's likely to be misleading.
Well, the term is the me generation.
Egoism would, I think, be at the top of any list of things to avoid. If only because an egoist in a way denies that there has to be any list of priorities. There's only one, me, and what I want. But that short list of priorities, of course, notoriously leads to conflict with other people of the same stripe, and is a very superficial way of looking at oneself, because our own identities are not so closed as that indicates. They connect with other people's. Who am I? Well, I have connections with a lot of people, with my family, my background, my history. The idea of the self as some atom seems to me to be a philosophical abstraction, if you will, that unfortunately has become very popular. It's not one that will withstand examination. We're subject to claims by other people. We have influences by other people that determine or influence a lot of what we do. Those are inescapable. And some of the most miserable people I know are the ones who attempt to escape them completely.
So you see philosophy as a social activity. It is not a hermit's off in a cave.
No, it's a social activity. And this is not, of course, a new idea. It's as old as Socrates. It's dialectic. It's essential form is dialogue, attempting to get straight about something, to say something one believes to be true and important, to say it perhaps in a hypothetical and tentative way, and then to see if one can show that it's false, to see if it will withstand examination in the light of some very concrete and undeniable facts that we know.
Why do people see philosophers as hermits? Why is philosophy so inaccessible?
I suspect it's the term that intimidates people, but actually it's not accessible, not inaccessible. In university courses, it's as accessible as anything. The books, of course, have, like any books that are the product of any disciplined activity, the books will have their own vocabulary, their own way of argument, their own unusual style. But once one gets past the initial obstacle of mastering that vocabulary and that style, it's, I suspect, no harder than physics or psychology or sociology.
Well, again, let's come back to what you're thinking and writing about it at the National Humanities Center. Practical wisdom is it's quite a challenging title.
I think if I had to give a short account of what it is to be practically wise in the way that moral criticism points to, I'd again return to the idea of a system of avoidances, of a sense of priorities in avoiding things. The person who is practically wise, I would argue, is the person who knows what to avoid, who can stay out of various kinds of moral difficulty and trouble. The person who can see that it's more important to avoid A than B than C, who has the sort of experience knack to look at a very tangled situation and to spot what's important to avoid. And I don't mean this to be too negative when I speak of a system of avoidances, because one of the things we wish to avoid most, I would argue, is having no positive goals, no aspirations, no ideals, no aims. That itself is a mistake. So even what we normally think of in a very positive way can, of course, be described as the product of having avoided a complementary kind of mistake. Most of what we do, whether it's wise or unwise, I think we do out of habit, mm-hmm. or out of a fairly deeply ingrained disposition that we've acquired when we're children or adolescents or young adults. We formed our ways of behaving, our normal ways of coping with situations, and these ways may be very fortunate or very unfortunate, but I don't think it's very controversial that we live most of our lives, so to speak, on autopilot, because the situations that we tend to face are repeatable. We face the same problems day after day after day. We don't have to rethink these situations anew. Again, another of the myths of our age is that somehow every situation is unique in some morally important way. I don't think that's true at all.
You're talking about situation ethics, huh?
I think so, yes. There are, of course, new situations and new problems that we face, and we have to be alert to these, but most of what's morally important is utterly commonplace and ordinary and undramatic and can be dealt with in habitual ways.
Well, what is morally important? What are the things to avoid?
Well, again, now you're talking about the content of this sense of priorities, the sorts of things that we look to. Uh-huh. This is, of course, part of what I'm writing on, but a very brief sketch would be that the principle of priority involved here is the principle of honoring the human agent, the autonomous, self-ruling being who can plan and aim and develop goals and projects and deliberate about how best to achieve these on his own, on her own. Mm-hmm. That's the center of it. Whatever injures or attacks that ability to function as an autonomous person, as an agent, a planner, a doer on one's own, is, I think, at the root of what we wish to avoid. This is why I believe we've developed the notion of rights, especially the negative rights that are captured in absolute and categorical commandments. Not to murder, for example.
That's an absolute or a categorical
commandment. Yes, I would say so. This absolute right to be spared that kind of attack is one of the roots of society, and it's at the basis, I think, of our sense of priorities. Mm-hmm. Hard on the heels of that would be another one, not to be lied to or deliberately deceived, because we need to process information accurately. We need the truth to make our plans, to deliberate, to mm-hmm. pursue our projects in common and individually. If we don't have that, we're attacked in a way. We're used, we're treated as things and not as human beings. Mm-hmm. Those, I think, are at the top of the list of priorities. There are, I believe, lesser priorities. The priority of what some people have called positive rights, the right to a fair share of some scarce commodity. On my view, the person of practical wisdom, the person who has a sound sense of priorities, knows how to rank these. And that comes only with experience and reflection. Mm-hmm. You can't get it out of a book. A book can perhaps help one see what to look for, but it comes with experience, with practice, with effort.
So you're talking about a habit of mind. This sounds an awful lot like religion. What's the difference?
The relationship between moral philosophy and religion is not, I think, a really difficult one to understand. Religious beliefs can, I think, give a morally conscientious person additional reasons to do what he or she thinks right and to avoid what is wrong. On the other hand, I know people of no religious persuasion whatever who are, in my judgment, morally admirable, where they get the strength to do what's morally admirable, to be as they are is another question, but I don't want to deny that there are people like that. But I also want to admit that religious conviction, religious belief is a strong underpinning for the moral life, not perhaps a wholly necessary one, but certainly a helpful one for a great many people.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation. Here again is your host, Wayne Pond.
Dr. John Moline came to the National Humanities Center as a scholar in residence during the academic year 1979 and 80. Dr. Moline is currently professor and chairman of the Department of Philosophy at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Dr. Moline has published widely on philosophical issues and figures ranging from Plato, Aristotle, and Socrates to work on ethics, sociobiology, and philosophy and rhetoric. My conversation with Professor Moline turns now to a discussion of moral philosophy and its place in modern life. Dr. Moline, exactly what is a moral philosopher?
A moral philosopher engages in philosophical investigation of morality. A person who attempts to clarify moral concepts, moral arguments, to understand moral reasoning, to lay this out in a way that we can understand it better. It's moral philosophy, essentially, that I'm doing when I'm attempting to describe this sense of priorities. Again, it's nothing, I hope, inaccessible or terribly difficult. It's simply the articulation, the expression of what, in a way, we all know already. Mm-hmm. There oughtn't to be anything terribly surprising to it. Mm-hmm. If there is, it's probably wrong.
Is there anything new under the sun, philosophically, then?
I'm inclined to say no. The more I've studied Plato and Aristotle, the more I think that the really important things have been anticipated. There are new things to say, certainly, if only because one has a new audience, a new vocabulary. A long tradition in moral philosophy has to be reinterpreted. The important things have to be said over again in a way that you and I can understand. So yes, they're new, but in a way they're not.
They have new audiences.
We have a kind of overweening pride and novelty in our century, I believe, and we think we're a lot more original and creative and fertile than in fact we are. The more one knows about the great philosophers of the past and the great people in this tradition, the less original and earth-shaking anything we write now looks.
What is the state of philosophy in 1980 in America or in the Western world?
It's changing. There, in the mainstream American universities, in the 50s and 60s, philosophy became rather specialized, rather technical. There was a lot of attention to the tools of philosophy. The tools were thought to be in a bad state of repair.
By the tools of philosophy, you mean
the tools
what?
Of logic, the tools of argument, the tools of conceptual analysis. There was a lot of attention to these. It was thought that these were a bit rusty. There was this tool-tending phase. Now that the tools appear to be in better shape, you find people actually using them to do more important things than I think were done earlier on. So in part, this is a response to developments in philosophy itself. In part, it's a response to the renewed call for the contribution of philosophers to discussing the major social and moral issues of our day.
Mm-hmm. Do you see a bright horizon for the role, the interplay between philosophy and life as we live it?
I think it's brighter than it was 20 years ago in my own department and in others that I know of. There's a good deal of interest on the part of the faculty and the students in questions of medical ethics, of legal ethics, environmental ethics, practical reasoning, logic applied to everyday activity. There is, in other words, an effort to translate the contributions of philosophy into something of practical importance for people. This is always, of course, what people have expected of philosophy, and some philosophers have always attempted to satisfy this expectation, but I think there's more of an attempt to do this now, more ability to do it now.
Could you give me an example? You mentioned medical ethics and environmental ethics.
The issues in these areas tend to be simply ordinary moral issues in a new guise and in a new context. They're not all like that, but most of them are. For example, the issue of lying to a patient or telling the truth to a patient. I had the opportunity to hear a very fine physician from Boston Children's Hospital who had had quite a lot of experience in medical ethics, and he was describing a situation which raises this issue, whether to tell the truth to the patient or not. He had a 12-year-old girl as his patient. She had an ovarian tumor, and he had to do a hysterectomy. Now, the girl's mother argued that he should not tell the girl that she had had a hysterectomy and would never be able to have children. And he told us that he realized, knowing the mother and a bit about her, that her real concern was with the girl's realizing that she couldn't get pregnant and perhaps becoming promiscuous. And he saw that that was the mother's real problem. He told the mother that he always told the truth to patients, that he had tried it the other way, and from sad experience, again, making the mistakes and then learning to avoid them, he had realized that it was wrong not to tell the truth, and that if she insisted on the daughter's not learning the truth, she would have to get a new physician. He finally persuaded the mother to let him tell the truth. He told the daughter, and she says, "Oh, that's okay." And his way of introducing it was important. He said, "You'll never be able to have children, but we'll help you with adoption." And the girl took it in a very matter-of-fact way. But he warned the mother that if she insisted on this girl's not finding out when she was 18, 20, 24, got married, or had a gynecological examination and discovered she had had a hysterectomy and her mother had not told her, she would hate her mother, break communication with her, perhaps never communicate with her the rest of her life, and have a lot of psychological problems. Mm-hmm. So he'd tried it both ways. He had that experience that had given him the practical wisdom to understand this. Mm-hmm. But in a way, it's a shame we have to learn from that kind of mistake and that kind of experience, isn't it? Because not lying is a fairly obvious sort of moral directive that I would presume we already knew, but this doctor went beyond simply not lying to the patient, though I suppose he would have had to do that to explain to her in some way what had happened. Mm-hmm. He argued that she should know the truth.
What do you see on the horizon? We hear a lot about how much technology is going to change our lives and is changing our lives. Is there a niche there, a role for philosophy to play in the kinds of decisions that people will have to face?
There certainly is. The role is realized perhaps more clearly by technologists and scientists than it is by some philosophers. In my own department, when I was chairman, we got calls from various departments in the engineering school asking for help, wanting instruction for their students, wanting consultation with their faculty, wanting to equip students to deal with the moral complications in some of the decisions they would be making, for example, in nuclear engineering. They wanted their students to know the various kinds of arguments that they would encounter and realize that if their students were equipped to do nuclear engineering but not equipped to understand the moral aspect of what they were doing, they would be really not very well equipped for their job.
If you could name maybe a title or two, something that, the average person could or should look at to explore further the issues that, you've been describing, where do you go to find out about things like this?
I think there's no better book in moral philosophy that's ever been published than Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. Mm-hmm. It's a very good place to start. It deals with virtue or excellence. It deals with happiness, with friendship, with justice, with most of the major issues. Of course, there have been developments that have been important since then, but some of these developments leave out important mm-hmm. themes that Aristotle was quite aware of, such as the importance of friendship. Friendship is a moral matter, and it's a sign of a person's moral character that this person has a lot of excellent friends. The person who has friends that aren't simply business friends or uh-huh. people with whom one has a good time, but friends who respect one's character is probably morally a more admirable person than somebody who's not respected by anybody.
What is being written or articulated, published today that would be of interest to an individual?
Well, again, pursuing the model of avoiding mistakes, I would suggest that people could look at a little paperback by J.J. C. Smart and Bernard Williams entitled Utilitarianism For and Against. This has been the major moral philosophy of our age and remains, I believe, the major moral philosophy guiding people in large bureaucracies, people in administrative positions. And this is a good examination of the merits and demerits of that kind of view. Another thing that I would suggest is Michael Scriven's Primary Philosophy. He has a really good chapter, I believe, on morality. Mm-hmm. A good introduction to the topic. Another thing, G.J. Warnock, The Object of Morality. A good treatment of some of the major themes in morality, with an eye to the substance, not just the form, the substance of morality, the concern with our human predicament, with malevolence and with lack of sympathy.
Professor Moline, thank you very much. Enjoyed talking with you, and continued good luck in your work at the National Humanities Center and at Madison, Wisconsin.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being with you.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the center is William Bennett. Soundings is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
This is Bill Bennett, Director of the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, inviting you to listen this week for Soundings, the Center's radio program. This week, Soundings provides a thoughtful conversation about philosophy and morality in modern life with Professor John Moline, a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center. What are the moral decisions that pervade one's life today? Listen for Professor Moline and his insights this week on Soundings.